Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hi, I'm Una Chaplin, and I'm the host of a new podcast called Hollywood Exiles. It tells the story of how my grandfather, Charlie Chaplin, and many others were caught up in a campaign to root out communism in Hollywood. Hollywood Exiles. From CBC Podcasts and the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jannat Jalil, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 29th of February, these are our main stories. Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the US Senate, has announced he'll step down from the role this year. Washington has said it firmly supports Moldova's territorial integrity after officials in the breakaway region of Transnistria called on Moscow for protection. Parliament in Ghana has overwhelmingly approved new legislation making it illegal to identify as gay or transgender. Also in this podcast... One academic's unusual way of making his research easier to understand. The US Senate's longest-serving Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, has announced he's stepping down from his leadership position in November when the US presidential election will be held. The 82-year-old has suffered health scares and has fallen out with Donald Trump in recent years over his election falsehoods. He announced his decision in an emotional speech in the chamber.
It's been an honor to work with each of you. There'll be plenty of time to express my gratitude in greater detail as I sprint towards the finish line, which is now in sight. I yield the floor.
Our Washington correspondent, Gary O'Donohue, told us more about Mitch McConnell and his importance to US politics.
He's been around for a very long time. He first entered the Senate in 1985, in the middle of the Reagan era. He's been there during that time, and George Bush Sr. and G.W. Bush, and through the Clinton era and the Obama era and the Trump era, in fact. So he's been there a very long time. He's the longest-serving leader in the Senate, and he's really had a reputation for being a pretty master tactician on the conservative side. He's kept together a party that at times has been pretty fractious, but in many ways the party that he joined, the party that he, you know, felt most at home in, is no longer the party of that kind of former, that brand of republicanism, because Donald Trump has moved it so far to the right that he's really a sort of bit of a fish out of water.
So do we know why he's decided to go now?
No, I mean, he didn't give any explicit reasons. I mean, he is 82. He has also had a number of health problems in the last couple of years that have drawn a lot of focus. And he's also, as I was mentioning there, you know, kind of out of step with the party as it is now. And he's sort of wrestling with whether or not to endorse Donald Trump in the upcoming election. He hasn't decided one way or another on that as yet. And I think he's, you know, he's struggling to get some of his priorities done. So, you know, he's just brokered a Ukraine package, getting a number of his colleagues to vote for that in the Senate. But the House Republicans simply won't pass it. And that's because the leadership in the House and the atmosphere among House Republicans is very, very much different to the party he knows. So he's struggling to keep things together in that sense. And he's obviously decided that this is the moment to step down, although he's going to continue as a senator for at least another couple of years.
And briefly, do you think that pressure on him to back Donald Trump might be a factor in his deciding to step down? I mean, do you think there's also a hint there perhaps to older leaders that perhaps they should take a leaf out of his book?
Well, that's been the big debate here in America. You know, the country is run by men in their late 70s and 80s, white men in their late 70s and 80s. And he is the first one to bow out, if you like. The others have shown no sign of that. Joe Biden, Donald Trump, both going full steam ahead for for November. But I think there is pressure on him to endorse Donald Trump. It's a personal decision for him because, of course, Donald Trump went after his wife, who was a cabinet secretary, Elaine Chao, some pretty racist comments about her. So he's not only grappling with what's best for the party and to get Republicans elected and get control of the Senate back in November, because they're not in control at the moment, but also these sort of personal factors and the fact that he blames Donald Trump for what happened on January the 6th.
Gary O'Donoghue in Washington. The US has said it firmly supports Moldova's territorial integrity after separatists in the breakaway region of Transnistria called on Russia for protection. The narrow strip of land along Moldova's border with Ukraine has been controlled by pro-Russian separatists since the breakup of the Soviet Union, but legally remains part of Moldova and is not internationally recognized. The US State Department spokesman, Matthew Miller, said that Washington was monitoring the situation in Transnistria.
Given Russia's increasingly aggressive and destabilizing role in Europe, we are watching Russia's actions in Transnistria and the broader situation there very closely. The United States firmly supports Moldova's sovereignty and territorial integrity within its internationally recognized borders.
Transnistria's appeal for Moscow to protect it from the pro-Western government of Moldova sounds very similar to calls made in regions of eastern Ukraine, now occupied by Russian forces. The Russia editor of BBC Monitoring, Vitaly Shevchenko, assesses what it means.
The thing to remember about Transnistria is that Russia has a large military base there, which allows it to exercise a significant amount of control over what's happening in Transnistria and over what such meetings say or do. In fact, it's doubtful that Transnistria would exist as a breakaway entity from Moldova if this Russian base was not there. And secondly, importantly, we need to remember that Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine started after Russia-backed and Russia-installed figures in eastern Ukraine had asked Russia for assistance. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that Russia is preparing to invade Moldova or launch an attack on Ukraine from Transnistria. It could just be a way of putting pressure on Ukraine, on Moldova, on the West. And also in the past, Transnistria held a referendum whose results were questioned by members of the international community. And that referendum supposedly showed that members of the public there, they want to join Russia. And also in the past, Russia-backed legislators in Transnistria, they also appealed to Russia to pass legislation to accept Transnistria into Russia. So this is a development that needs to be watched closely.
Vitaly Shevchenko. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has called on leaders from 11 southeastern European nations to help his country produce ammunition. Addressing a summit in Albania, Mr. Zelensky said supply problems were affecting Ukraine's ability to fight Russia. Guy Delaunay reports.
Volodymyr Zelensky told the Western Balkans leaders that ammunition supplies were a major issue for Ukraine. His proposed solution was what he called a joint forum for the defense industry between Ukraine and the Balkans.
All of us, I think we have to prepare. For what? Just to be strong. To prepare for war or peace, it's not about it. To prepare for Putin's next steps. If not all of us want to push him back, it means that we have to prepare.
Most of the countries in the region have been steadfast in their support for Ukraine, with the notable exception of Serbia. But the summit's host, Albania's Prime Minister Edi Rama, said the gathering proved that countries in the Balkans were united in standing resolutely with Ukraine against a very real threat to Europe's security and to global order.
Guy Delaunay. Here in the UK, a Bulgarian painter and decorator has appeared in court accused of being part of a Russian spy ring. Tihomir Ivanchev is alleged to have carried out surveillance. He joins five other Bulgarian nationals who are set to go on trial this year after being charged with the same offence. Daniel de Simone was at the court in central London.
The 38-year-old man is alleged to have been part of an organised network of UK-based Bulgarians conducting surveillance against people and places targeted by Russia. Five other people were charged last year and faced trial in October, but Mr. Ivanchev's alleged role emerged as chat group messages were translated by detectives. Mr. Ivanchev is a painter and decorator and was previously in a relationship with a beautician who is one of those to have already been charged. The group, allegedly run from a guest house in Norfolk, is said to have carried out surveillance to assist Russia in conducting hostile actions, including potential abductions. Mr. Ivanchev is alleged to have had a role in surveillance abroad in 2021 and 2022. He was remanded in custody.
Daniel DeSimone. A group of more than 50 broadcast journalists has sent an open letter to the embassies of Israel and Egypt calling for free and unfettered access to Gaza for foreign media. Nearly 5 months into the war in Gaza, reporters are still barred from entering apart from rare escorted trips with the Israeli military. The letter, sent by correspondents and presenters from the UK's main broadcasting outlets, also appeals for better protection for the Palestinian journalists reporting in the territory, 90 of whom are believed to have been killed in the Israeli bombardment. The signatories to the letter include the BBC's Jeremy Bowen, Orla Guerin and Fergal Keane, CNN's Christian Amanpour and Sky's Alex Crawford. She told us more about why they'd done this.
The main thinking is that we're all terribly frustrated and feel we're not really doing ourselves justice. We're not doing the story justice and people aren't hearing particular information because foreign journalists aren't on the ground. And this is despite multiple attempts to try to get access into Gaza since October the 7th. From October the 7th onwards, there have been groups of people, teams of people, media organisations from all over the world trying to get access into Gaza, and we haven't been able to. And that definitely compromises what is probably one of the most important developing events in certainly in the region for many, many decades, possibly in the world, and will have ramifications for many years to come.
Alex, you've travelled the world with your reporting and you're in Iraq at the moment. How unusual is it in your experience and through your career to have been unable to access an area, particularly one that is the centre of a major story?
I think it's not unusual that some governments and some regimes will try to keep you out. And that presents definitely a challenge for journalists to try and report accurately inside. But we, in the past, and even now, we're talking about governments or authorities or regimes that do not describe them as themselves as democracies, which Israel does describe itself as. Israel is proud of boasting that it is a liberal democracy with an open media, and yet it is deliberately blocking journalists from all over the world from getting into Gaza. That is the key difference. I mean, in the past, journalists like myself have had to use boats to get into Myanmar, have had to use all sorts of tactics to try to get inside closed off areas. And we've managed it. This one is monumentally difficult because it is an extremely small area that we're talking about. There are only two border points, and it is really, really very massively locked down by Israel and also by Egypt. And seriously, most governments around the world should be worried about that.
Alex Crawford from Sky News speaking to Rajini Vaidyanathan. Israel's Supreme Court rejected the foreign media's request for access to Gaza last month on security grounds, saying their entry could endanger Israeli forces. Still to come, Saudi Arabia has made its biggest financial push yet into the world of tennis.
The Saudi authorities, through the Public Investment Fund, will be pouring a lot of money into the sport. The amount has not been disclosed. They will become the official naming partner of the ATP World Rankings.
The Global Story helps make sense of the headlines with expert analysis from BBC journalists around the world.
Social media has essentially siloed a lot of young men and women into different algorithmic bubbles.
Men and women inhabiting the same environment in the real world, but very different ones online.
One global story at a time, in detail, every Monday to Friday from the BBC World Service.
For those Russians who sympathise with Alexei Navalny, it will cast a very dark shadow.
This looks like a message.
Search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. MPs in Ghana have unanimously passed a bill that further restricts the rights of gay and transgender people. It includes a 3-year jail term for people identifying as LGBT. Anyone promoting the activities of sexual minorities faces a 5-year sentence. This is how some members of the LGBT community in Ghana have reacted.
I'm so scared, very scared, and I don't know my fate.
My life is at stake. It will be my end in Accra. A relative told me if this bill is being passed, any chance he gets is going to poison me. I feel like relocating from the country itself to any LGBT country which is safe for me to live in.
The bill still needs to be signed by President Nana Akufo-Addo before it comes into effect. Those who oppose it say the legislation will infringe on people's rights and freedoms, something which is guaranteed in the country's constitution. Proponents of the bill argue it will help to preserve Ghanaian family values. Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, told us more about the proposed legislation.
Worth mentioning that the current law, so the law that has been there for many decades, already states that anyone having gay sex should go to prison for 3 years. So that's to give you some context that there already is that law in place. So these are new provisions, including imposing a maximum 5-year jail term for anyone forming or funding LGBTQ plus groups. And there are other provisions, up to 10 years for anyone involved in LGBTQ plus advocacy campaigns aimed at children. And members of the public are encouraged to kind of report on others. And this has gone on now for 3 years, this bill. Interesting that it was proposed by the party that's currently in opposition, but unanimously passed in Parliament. So both the main parties in agreement on this. Worth mentioning also that it's an election year in Ghana, and because of widespread, as we just heard in those voices, there is a feeling amongst many Ghanaians that being gay is taboo. People will say they're very religious. They'll say it doesn't match with their religion. Now, if any member of parliament were to stand up and say, I do not support this bill, I think it would be fair to say that that would be a vote-losing move by that parliamentarian. So perhaps that explains why it was unanimously passed. And we now have to see what the president, Nana Akufo-Addo, does, because it doesn't become a law unless he signs it into law.
Will Ross. Violence has broken out in Chad a day after it was announced that a presidential election will be held in May and June. Heavy gunfire was heard on Wednesday in the capital, N'Djamena, after several people were killed in earlier clashes near Chad's internal security agency. The government of the military ruler, Idriss Deby, who's running as a candidate in the election, blamed an opposition party, but the opposition said troops had opened fire. Our reporter in Abuja, Chris Yoko, has been monitoring the volatile situation in Chad.
Today, what we do know is that there's been tension in N'Djamena, the capital of Chad, and this is as a result of the announcement of killing of several people after individuals alleged from the opposition Socialist Party Without Borders attacked the National Security Agency. The government said that members of the party attacked the agency and some were killed, some had been arrested, but that the government is now searching for more of the members. This has triggered tension, and security agents have been stationed in strategic locations around the capital.
But the opposition is saying it was soldiers who opened fire.
Some members of the opposition were arrested, including one of their leaders. So there were fears that the top leader of that party, Socialist Party Without Borders, may have been killed. So the members said they went in search of their leader, and then they alleged that soldiers opened fire on them. So there had been conflicting accounts of what happened, because when the government is saying that members of the opposition party attacked the National Security Agency, the opposition party is accusing the government of attacking members of the party.
And this violence has broken out a day after it was announced that elections would be held in May. Currently, Chad has a military ruler, Idriss Deby. He's going to be one of those candidates in the presidential election. So it seems like there's a bit of a power struggle going on here.
Yeah, I think basically what's happening in Chad is more like a power struggle. Idriss Deby, the current military ruler, took power from after his father was killed. And so he transformed and became the president of the transition of Chad. Now a party, which is the government party, has picked him as its main candidate, even though he has not commented whether he accepts or not. But there are other members of opposition parties that are also jostling for power. And with the election now called for May, on May 6th, just about two or three months from now, it's going to be a very difficult situation if such a crisis that has started, if it transforms into a bigger conflict, a political conflict.
Chris Uoko. The International Criminal Court has awarded more than $52 million in compensation to victims of the Ugandan warlord Dominic Ongwen. He was a top commander in the Lord's Resistance Army militia. Anna Holligan reports.
The court identified almost 50,000 victims of Dominic Ongwen's crimes. Each person who suffered, directly or otherwise, will be awarded a symbolic €750, or around $800. The judge cautioned the victims cannot expect to receive payments immediately. The reparations order also noted the physical, moral, material and transgenerational harm and awarded collective compensation for community projects to rehabilitate and rebuild broken lives. The judge recounted incidents of babies thrown into bushes because they were crying, women and girls kept as sexual slaves, and people who were kidnapped forced to kill each other.
Anna Holligan. It was once China's largest property company, but now Country Garden is struggling to even stay in business. A liquidation petition has been filed against it for non-payment of a $205 million loan. It's part of the sorry story of China's real estate sector in recent years, a sector that makes up around a quarter of the country's GDP but is now mired in debt. A liquidation of Country Garden would be a serious blow for the economy of China, which has been stuttering in the aftermath of the COVID pandemic. Roger Hearing asked Thomas Hale, the Shanghai correspondent for the Financial Times, will the property firm be wound up?
The question's kind of split into two halves here, because Chinese property developers, although they are listed in Hong Kong and they have their holding companies in Hong Kong, the vast, vast majority of their developments and their assets are in mainland China. And of course, Hong Kong and mainland China operate according to completely different legal regimes. A liquidation order in Hong Kong of the kind that creditors are now seeking for Country Garden would not really allow liquidators to seize assets in the mainland unless a equivalent mainland court issued a similar order. So the likelihood of Country Garden's Hong Kong entities being liquidated is reasonably high if they don't come up with a restructuring plan. But there are very deep question marks over whether a liquidation could actually occur on the mainland where most of its developments are.
Because we've kind of been here before, because Evergrande, which is another similarly in trouble property company, got an order from liquidation from Hong Kong court recently already.
It's exactly the same situation. Of course, the difference between the two is that Evergrande sparked the ongoing Chinese property slowdown in 2021 when it defaulted, and it was the kind of problem child of the sector. It had always been too indebted. It was the world's most indebted developer. Country Garden, by contrast, which defaulted in October, so 2 years later, had prior to that been seen as a safe bet. People thought that Country Garden was relatively sheltered from the chaos that was going on in the property sector, and the fact that it wasn't, and that it not only defaulted but is now the subject of this liquidation order, really just shows how big the problem is for Beijing in terms of fixing the property slowdown.
And I guess even if, as you say, they aren't necessarily going to have their goods seized in China itself, nonetheless the pressure on shareholders must be extreme. The impression and the confidence that these companies kind of rely on must disappear.
In fact, this has become pretty much the most important confidence test for overseas investment into China. Enormous amounts of money, in excess of $100 billion, has flowed from Hong Kong into real estate development in China as part of China's vast urbanization process. And we're about to get a pretty clear-cut view. It might take a few years to become exactly apparent. What happens when your investments in the mainland go wrong? Are you able to pursue conventional legal processes? Or is it a place and an investment market where you have no hope of getting your money back at all when things go wrong?
Thomas Hale, the FT's Shanghai correspondent. Saudi Arabia has made its biggest push into tennis so far. The nation's sovereign wealth fund has signed a major deal with the governing body of men's tennis, the ATP. The Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has presided over unprecedented spending on sport since becoming Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler, leading to accusations that he's trying to distract attention from human rights abuses by sports washing. Our tennis correspondent, Russell Fuller, told us more about the Saudi deal.
This deal, Janat, is with the men's ATP Tour, and it is described as a multi-year strategic partnership. The Saudi authorities, through the Public Investment Fund, will be pouring a lot of money into the sport. The amount has not been disclosed. They will become the official naming partner of the ATP World Rankings, and they will have a specific connection to tour events in Indian Wells in California. You'll see the branding on the court when that tournament is staged next week, in Miami in Florida, and also the events in Madrid and Beijing, and the season-ending ATP Finals for the top eight singles and doubles pairs of the year. One country that did not want to be part of this is the United Kingdom. The Lawn Tennis Association were offered the chance to have a similar deal to those other tournaments for on-court sponsorship with PIF, but the LTA turned the opportunity down when they were approached in January.
And there will be those who say this is yet another example of Saudi Arabia sports washing.
I had a very interesting and long conversation with the president of the Saudi Tennis Federation, Arij Al-Mutabagani, at the end of last year. And I asked her specifically what she made of the term sports washing. And she laughed when answering the question, but she said it was their way of promoting the country and, to her, to grow the game and to make sure that not just women are playing the game more regularly, but also younger people in Saudi Arabia get the opportunity. But we are seeing this on a industrial scale, aren't we, across a number of different sports like football, golf, Formula One and boxing. And tennis's footprint in Saudi Arabia is increasing all the time. The next gen ATP finals for the rising stars of the game took place in Jeddah for the first time last November. There's four more years of that deal left to run. Exhibitions taking place on a regular basis, and there is still the hope in Saudi Arabia that the season-ending WTA finals on the women's tour will head to Saudi Arabia from the end of this year.
Russell Fuller. Scientists sometimes struggle to make their findings interesting to those of us for whom chemistry and biology lessons are just a hazy memory. But one Brazilian biologist has come up with a unique way of bringing his research to life. Dr. Welly Costa created and starred in an award-winning music video to illustrate his PhD on the behaviour of kangaroos. Anna Murphy reports.
Are you doing the east today or the north?
The video begins with Dr. Welly Costa driving through an Australian plain, observing a group of kangaroos. At first, it looks like a usual documentary about his research, until... The serene scene of grazing kangaroos is joined by drag queens, ballerinas, classical Indian dancers, street dancers, you name it really. And Dr. Welly Costa uses this vast array of performers to illustrate what he learnt about the behaviour types of kangaroos, focusing on the way they act when they work together. Some things I learned from my kangaroo time. So, what did he learn?
So they still have their personality, but when they're in groups and they're responding as a group, they change their behavior a lot and they adjust to each other. And the way they do is actually democratic, meaning it doesn't matter if there are more males or females in the group, whether they are older or younger, or even if they're individuals with extreme personality in the group, they all adjust to each other. So there's no evidence for leadership or to one individual driving the response in the group. It's a perfect average of everybody's personality.
The link between these findings and dancing drag queens and ballerinas may not be immediately obvious, But it becomes clear as the dancers begin to interact and to adopt each other's movements.
The viewer for the video has that clear idea that those dancers, they are different in behavior. So they illustrate the difference in kangaroo personality. And as those individuals travel between groups of dancers from different styles, they also change the way they move. If it's a ballet dancer, they start, when they're by themselves, showcasing pure ballet movements. And as they travel to samba group, for example, they start changing that behavior.
The clip has won the top prize awarded annually by the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And as the video comes to a close, the overarching message appears on the screen. Differences lead to diversity. It exists within any given species. It's just natural.
That report by Anna Murphy. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Charlotta Tojimska. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye. Thank you.